Well, we've come to the end, brothers and sisters, and hopefully your studies of James this week have been something where you can look at the book maybe from a slightly different perspective than you have in the past. I think you're good sports to drop all your packing up for the moment and come here to a class and sneak the last one in. Thank you for that. You're all a bunch of good sports to do that, and hope the packing up goes really well afterwards. It's been a lot of fun for us to be here. We've really enjoyed getting to know all of you and be able to see you a little bit at this Bible camp this week. And now we have some good thoughts about our brethren and sisters and their kids here in the Perth area when we go back home to the USA. Well, where are we coming, James? You go back and hopefully you can look back over the book of James or his letter and sort of reflect back over what we've done this week. We started out on Sunday at the exhortation looking at how James was trying to appeal on the basis that we must be single-minded and really believe, really this is the foundation of his letter, we must believe that God's involved in our life, that his angels are out there doing things, they are responsible for the events that happen in our lives, and that must be a single-minded approach. We can't waver from that, because if we waver, then we'll start to take events of our life, things that happen in our life, and we'll start to slide them over to the side that, well, God's not involved. And it really is important for God to talk to us and for us to respond to what he's doing in our life, that we honestly believe that God is involved. And then we start to work out, well, what are we supposed to learn from this? What is God trying to teach us through those events? We looked at in chapter 1 that when God is involved and bad things happen to us, which they will sometimes, though bad things will occur, that it's not that God's trying to destroy us. He doesn't tempt you with evil so that you'll sin and make mistakes. He brings about circumstances in our life. Angels custom make trials for us that we need in order to develop God's character, because they're working on aspects of our life that we don't really have right yet. And so they custom make these trials, not so that we will sin and that we will fall, but they're hoping that we will succeed and that we will continue to grow in the character of God and that we will become lights that will shine. That's God's goal in all of this, is that he can turn us into lights that will reflect his glory to the honor and glory of God. We then looked at the end of James 1, how James then listed a whole bunch of things at the end of chapter 1 that he then will expand on in the rest of the letter. So that in James chapter 2, we started looking at partiality. That we can't claim to be children of God and yet show partiality to our brothers and sisters or to their children or to other people that walk in off the streets and come in from our seminars. We have to be like God. And God's not like that. He doesn't show partiality based on all those things that we tend to look at about people and we make judgments. And he dealt with that idea of judging one another like that quite a bit in this letter. And we looked at how he then dealt with the fact in chapter 2 that we can't claim to have a faith. We can't say that, well, you know, I knew all the doctrines and I was baptized and I was baptized so many years ago, and yet our faith doesn't affect the way we live and how we treat other people. So that when we see a brother in need or we see a sister or a family or somebody that has needs, we have to be the kind of person that, because we love them, we will jump up and we will help out and help them through their needs. We can't just give them the pat on the back and say, well, have a good day, brother, and send them on their way. And we haven't done anything to help them. What kind of faith is that, James would say. And so then he gives us some examples of like an Abraham and a Rahab, maybe two extreme cases, but people whose faith generated works in their life. Not works of law, but works where you go outside the box, trusting in God that he'll take care of it, fully convinced, if necessary, that God will resurrect us from the dead, even if we lose our life in this, or if our child loses their life, like with Abraham, or with Rahab, thinking that when she hid the spies, she didn't know what would happen. It could have cost her life, but she's willing to go outside the box and do that because she's convinced in the resurrection from the dead. Those would be the kind of things Paul would bring up and throw into Hebrews 11. People who acted in such a way, they were fully convinced in the promises of God. And then in chapter 3, oh, we moved on to that tongue, right? That tongue that gives us away because it speaks what's really here in the heart. In fact, when we were looking at the tongues yesterday, I thought, well, you know, we had some good examples of tongues that were out there. Some of us decided to pick the tongue as our little sand sculpture. And you can see the resemblance that's there, can't you, of the attempt that was made by one group to do sort of like a self-portrait of someone in the camp. And I don't know what you think there, but I think they did pretty good, didn't they? It didn't turn out too bad. Couldn't determine which picture was actually best about the tongue right there, but you know how those tongues are. They just, like, they give us away in the things that we say. And so James would go on and look at that, because he's trying to give us little tests as we go along through the prejudice, through the judging, through the tongue. He's trying to help us to see, don't deceive yourself. Don't think we're better than we are. That isn't how it works. Because if we go through these Bible classes and we do the readings and we listen to Bible classes and we think, well, that's for everybody else in the audience. That's not for me. I've already got it down. If that's the kind of person we are, then God really can't touch our hearts and he can't help us to change. So James tries to give us enough examples like that with the tongue and so on that he can help us realize that, wait a minute, we've got areas we need to work on. We haven't made it yet. We're still being shaped and changed and conformed to the image of Christ. That's what James was after. And then in chapter 4 then, what he did is he went into these issues of what about in ecclesial life and in family life, how are you doing on controlling yourself so that you don't go to war, you don't verbally spar with other people, you don't get into these angry debates with one another. How are you doing on that? And he points out that that isn't what God's like. When somebody makes a mistake, and we sort of wander away from what we should be doing, he calls us adulteresses. But when we commit spiritual adultery, God wants us back. So what he does is he gives more grace to us, hoping that we will respond to his love and his kindness and his mercy, and realizing that, wow, if that's what God has done for me, how can we not do that for other people? And then James left us in chapter 4 yesterday with some examples of, all right, so you think you're doing okay on this. Well, and the solution is humility. What we need to do is humble ourselves before God, and if we really do see ourselves low, and we're all down there together, that we're all on an equal footing, we're all, we make many mistakes, and we all are under the hand of God, and we all need God's help and his grace and his kindness and his mercy, then we'll be able to treat other people the right way and respond. So James left us with two little tests there to find out, well, how are we doing on humility? How are we really doing? We might think we're humble, but when it comes time to looking at other people in ecclesial life and their families, do we really have humility, or do we judge them? Do we go around and we look at other people constantly judging them and trying to see their mistakes and how I'm better than them? And if we're doing that kind of thing, we really don't have the humility that James is talking about. And then he left off with the last example, was this concept at the end of chapter 4, that when God has blessed us with economic with gains, and he's given us finances, and we happen to have the ability to do things, we have the health, and we have the financial resources to make plans. When we make our plans, do we make our plans in the sense that, look at what I'm going to do, and tell everybody about all the things that I'm going to do, or do we say, well, God willing, here's what I hope to do. God willing, we plan to do this. And we bring God into the picture, because single-minded people, that's what they will do. So he ended up chapter 4 with that section about don't boast about tomorrow. Because at verse 16, when you boast in your arrogance, and all such boasting is evil. And therefore, to him who knows to do good and does not do it, to him it is sin. Now, what a touching verse to end up with in chapter 4. That when we know the right thing to do and we don't do it, then we've committed sin. And now what he's going to do in chapter 5 is he's going to move on now to his final section of dealing with, of trying to help the strangers that have been scattered abroad, people that are going to be experiencing family, ecclesial troubles and persecutions, mainly from the outside here, that Jews were going to bring problems on them. And then James knew that what was coming down the line is that the Romans were coming in. The Romans would come in eventually and bring persecution into the ecclesia, especially if you've been scattered out of Jerusalem and you were out in the empire, that the brethren and sisters, especially Jews and anybody connected with Jews, were going to suffer persecution in the years to come. And he tries to help them through this issue. Well, when bad times come, what are you going to do? What are you going to do when problems arise like that? And he deals with the need for patience. So you see that in chapter 5, that's really what he's after. Bad things are going to happen. Let's face it. It's not going to be a rosy thing. You go home to your ecclesias. Monday morning starts up. People are back at school. They're back at work. And you're back to the reality of life. And when that happens, there's going to be troubles that come into ecclesial life and family life. And it could be economic problems that are coming on your country. The United States has experienced that in the last few years. Many of our brothers and sisters lost their jobs. And people are just barely getting by, and ecclesias are trying to help out. So it could be that times are coming like that as well. And so James, what he leaves them with is this idea of a single-minded person. If you really believe God's involved, you won't waver from the fact that somehow God is going to use this for good. God's in this, and what he's doing is he's trying to help us develop into his children, and he'll use those economic problems or he'll use those persecutions that come up in order to develop us into his children. Now, when he starts out chapter 5, though, the first six verses of chapter 5, when you look at those, the first six verses or so are all about the oppression of the rich. Don't worry, Jeff, not going to break it off. They're all about the oppression of the rich and all of the trouble that the rich were going to bring into their life. I'm going to use the piano bench. That'll work. So when he starts out this section here about the rich, and you start wondering, well, who are these rich that he's talking about? James starts out with this section here, and it almost sounds like he's one of the prophets when he talks about wailing and weeping and howling for the misery that's coming on you in verse 1. So you wonder, like, who are those people that he's talking about? He uses phrases like weep and wail like that, which they're sort of echoes of like Isaiah 13, when Isaiah had said to wail, or to howl it is in the King James, for the day of the Lord is at hand. It will come as destruction from the Almighty. And when those phrases are generally used in the Old Testament, they're usually used about destruction coming from God. See, this is single-mindedness again, that God is going to be involved. Jeremiah 25, wail or howl, shepherds, and cry, and roll about in the ashes, you leaders of the flock. For the days of your slaughter and your dispersions are fulfilled, and you shall fall like a precious vessel. Or in Micah 1, there again, therefore, I will wail and howl, I will go stripped and naked, and make a wailing like the jackals, and the mourning like the ostriches. So it appears that what James does here in chapter 5, the first few verses, is maybe for the sake of the brethren and sisters, he sort of like launches out into a bit of a prophecy about the rich. Reminding the brethren and sisters that it's okay if these rich Jews are oppressing you right now, if you are feeling the burden of the folks that have control over you and they're dominating your life right now, and they're bringing you, and like he had said earlier, that, you know, these rich people, what do? Aren't they the ones that blaspheme God? Aren't they the ones that drag you into court and they're taking things away from you? If you are suffering through these persecutions right now from the rich, don't worry. God's got it in control. And those are going to be the people that get up, they're going to get hit first by the Romans. When the Romans came through and started to strip the Jews of all of their wealth, they're going to lose that in that day when the Romans come upon you. So he predicts their ruin of the rich, really, in these first few verses, that the days are going to come when their riches are going to be corrupt, their garments are going to be moth-eaten, and their gold and their silver are going to perish. And you can see in verse 3, for example, that their gold and their silver are corrupted. The corrosion will be a witness against you, and you will eat your flesh like fire. And you've heaped up treasure in the last days. So he's trying, I think when we look at what he's attempting to do, he's acknowledging the fact that, yes, you're going through persecutions, troubles are in your life, but it's okay. Single-minded people trust the fact that God is in control, and the days are going to come when God will handle it. You don't have to handle it right now. You don't have to go out and take vengeance right now. You don't have to yell and scream at these people. You can patiently endure through this, trusting that God will take care of it. Because as he points out, that what the rich had done is they had abused the law. They weren't following, these Jews weren't even following their Old Testament law. In Leviticus 19, that chapter that's all about that, love your neighbor as yourself. You find that in Leviticus 19, you have, you shall not cheat your neighbor, nor rob him. And the wages of him who is hired shall not remain with you all night until the morning. God had laid out very clear, practical things about how the rich, those in control, should treat those that were the poor, that were working for them. And you don't treat them like that. You don't withhold their wages. You don't keep their stuff even that was given in pledge. Instead, you let them have it. You give it back, believing that God's in control. And the cry of the reapers in this case, as he says in verse 5 there, in verse 4, that the cry of the reapers has reached the ears of the Lord of Sabaoth. It's that phrase that comes out of the Old Testament, you know, the Lord of hosts, or the God of, or the Lord of armies, or something like that. And any time that phrase is used, it's generally picked up, most of the time at least in the Old Testament, about God's judgments coming upon them, that the Lord of armies, he's got his armies ready to go. Now, when you look at that phrase there, though, the Lord of Sabaoth, at the end of verse 4, there's an interesting thing that comes out of that, if you just think about it for a minute. James and Paul, here we go again, our two writers, James and Paul, just to show how they're on the same page. If you go back and look at Romans 9 and verse 29. Now, when Paul wrote to the Romans, this Paul's letter to the Romans would have been later on, not quite as early as James's letter. But look at Romans 9 and verse 29. I think it's worth at least noting in our community today that this actually happens in the Bible. Two places in the Bible where Lord of Sabaoth is actually used. And maybe the one in Romans 9 is even clearer, because in Romans 9, what he's doing is quoting Isaiah chapter 1. And he references in Romans 9 at verse 29, "And as Isaiah said before, unless the Lord of Sabaoth had left us a seed, we would have become like Sodom, and we would have become like Gomorrah." They're thankful that God had actually saved them, but it was of God's election. That's why he brings it up in Romans 9. God was in control. God was controlling, made the promises to Abraham, and he promised Abraham that through his seed he would actually develop the Messiah, and the nations would be blessed. But in doing that, isn't it interesting that there were two times that Bible writers, two men, James and Paul, quote or refer to an Old Testament phrase that's so common, the Lord of hosts, Yahweh of armies, Yahweh of hosts. And both times they transliterate the Hebrew word Sabaoth. So you know they're trying to grab Jews in this case. They're using a Jewish phrase, Sabaoth, and they're transliterating it. They don't translate it. They transliterate it into the Greek and keep the word Sabaoth. That was the Hebrew word. But they refuse to transliterate Yahweh. Isn't that interesting? They ever wondered why? Why would they do that? Why would they take Yahweh of armies, which we would just use freely today, and refuse to use the word Yahweh? And instead they put in the Greek word Kyrios. Now, I got a feeling, brothers and sisters, that they knew, James and Paul, when they had their Jerusalem conferences, and they got together, and they realized that Paul was taking the gospel out to the Gentiles, it wouldn't surprise me at all if they had had discussions about this. And they realized that when they took the gospel out to the Gentiles, if they had insisted on the use of the word Yahweh, that the Jews would always have something on top of the Gentiles, that Yahweh is our God. And you know, they'd always be able to use that, and it wouldn't bring peace in the ecclesia. When Paul wrote to the Romans, that was his problem. You're writing to the Romans. These were the Gentiles of Rome who felt they were superior. And you had the Jewish element in Rome who felt they had the law, they had the prophets, they were of the fathers. Both groups felt they were superior. And so what Paul and James attempt to do is never let one group have it over the other one. And I have a feeling that what they did with the word Yahweh, which was the name that the Jews would have used of their God, is that they probably refused to let that become a divisive element in ecclesial life. And instead of insisting on its use, they gave in on that. It was one of those areas where you compromise. It wasn't essential. You don't have to refer to him as Yahweh. And so twice, both Paul and James refused to put in the word Yahweh when you would expect for sure it would be there, and in a place where they're transliterating Yahweh of hosts. And instead they put in Kyrios, and they call it Lord of Sabaoth. Now, I don't know if you ever thought of that before, but you know, somebody has to come up with an explanation. What's going on there? And when you look at it within the realm of the first century ecclesia, to me it makes a lot of sense. They didn't want to let God's name, the name at which we refer to as the only one God, they didn't want to let his name become a divisive element. And yet here we are sitting in our day and age, thousands of years later, and if we're not careful, that very thing can creep back into the Christadelphian community, where the name of God can become a divisive element, something God would be abhorred about, in which the apostles set out to make sure this doesn't happen. And so they changed. They gave in on the issue. And instead of using that, they refer to him as the Father. They call him the Father of the Lord Jesus Christ, which is probably the way God wanted to be remembered anyways, because now he had his Son, And now with the Son, you have the relationship of the Father and the Son and the family that they were creating, and that is where the emphasis was. And so instead of using the word Yahweh, even in Revelation chapter 1, when you get to the point where it's the revelation of Jesus Christ, he doesn't use the word. Instead, he says, from him who is and who was and who is to come. And they would give a description of it rather than even using the name. I find that really interesting, and it's something that has implications for our community today. We don't let the name of God become a divisive element any more than they did. And so if that's happening in ecclesial life today, it's an area that we want to work on and try to eliminate it. It should never have been a divisive element. And I think you can see between Paul's use in Romans 9 and James here in James chapter 5, it was not an essential thing. If it was so essential, then when you transliterate a phrase, they would have certainly have thrown it in. And they don't. At least it's not in our Bibles. So as he warns the rich, what you've done is you've heaped up treasure in the last days. That instead of setting up treasure for God, these people had heaped up treasure that was going to be held accountable to them. And you look back at things like some of the parables that Jesus gave, like in Luke 12, when he said about the fellow that heaped up all these treasures and built up all his barns, and God would say to him, "You fool, this night your soul will be required of you." Then whose will those things be which you have provided? So is he who lays up treasure for himself and is not rich towards God. So we don't want to be doing those kind of things. Our treasure doesn't want to be in the stuff that we have, in our homes, in our possessions, in our caravans, in our boats, in our toys, and all those kind of things. Where our treasure should be, brothers and sisters, is in our ecclesia, in the kingdom, in the family of God. That's where we want to commit our time and our finances and our efforts. Rather than as these rich people did, that they were so worried about their stuff, they would abuse other people, take advantage of them, and not share what they had with the poor. And James says, look, at your corroded riches are going to eat your flesh like fire. It's almost like they're going to burn right through you, almost like an acid would do in this case. That's how he saw it happening. And that they were unaware, the rich that were caught up in all this, they were totally unaware of what was going on. They were living their life like an animal that was getting ready for the day of slaughter. And God was letting things go on and letting things go on until they were so full of their riches and had taken all their advantage of the poor. And then finally the Romans were going to turn on them and they were going to get their justlies at that point. But the individual brethren and sisters had to patiently wait. We can't go out and take vengeance now. We can't go out and go after these people and get all so frustrated about it, about everything being solved now and equal now. He just says, look, be patient. Be patient. God will take care of it in his own time. And when God takes care of it, he'll do a much better job than we could ever do of taking care of this issue. And certainly the judgment was coming because the Lord of hosts, you know, as he calls him, that the Lord of Sabaoth was going to be brought in and he was going to use the Roman army and go after those Jews. And he was going to persecute those Jews and they would end up suffering tremendously as a result of the fact that they had persecuted the poor. And in this case, what the Romans did when they came in is they went after the Jews that had wealth. They didn't care about the ones that were poor. They wanted the stuff that people had. They wanted their homes. They took over their possessions. And so those very Jews that were causing these brethren and sisters so much trouble, they were the first ones that felt the wrath of the Roman army as it came out in the Romans began the persecution somewhere around AD 70. That phrase of Lord of Hosts, you can go back and look at it. It's used back in Jeremiah about 70 times, 50 in Isaiah, 24 in Malachi. And just about every time it's used, it's about Yahweh's armies being used to destroy and bring judgment upon some people that have violated his commands. And in this case, it was going to be about the destruction of the Jewish nation. That's in Jeremiah. That's what you'll find nearly every time. That's the way that phrase is picked up. So if you wonder, like, there is some debate when you study James. Some people wonder, well, who are the rich? Were they the rich in the ecclesia, or were they the rich Jews that were out there in Judaism that were still involved with the ecclesia? And I don't know about you. You can go back and look at it. My conclusion was that they were probably those that were really not brethren and sisters. He never refers to these people as brethren. Did you notice that as you're reading through chapter 5 there? He never refers to them as the brethren. Instead, he says, my brethren, these things should be, not be, or my brethren, you know, to consider the prophets. There were brethren and sisters he's writing to, but it doesn't seem to be these people. The first five or six verses of James 5 make no reference to the rich, to the brethren and sisters. Instead, these rich are all about these rich people that were oppressing them, and it's probably a reflection back on James 2 about the rich people that would oppress them and drag them into courts, and they blasphemed that noble name by which they were called. And then he introduces the brethren in verses 7 and 9 and 10 and 12 and 19. So when he wants to, he very clearly switches over to the brethren and sisters in the ecclesia. So that's just a suggestion, at least, as to what's happening in that first group there. And he condemns them for the fact that they had murdered the just as the Jewish nation had before murdered Jesus. In this case, they were killing. They were abusing just believers. They were picking on the brethren and sisters of the community. You even find that the historians record a few years later that the Jews stoned James the Less, or James the Just, as he's sometimes called, to death. This is how they picked on him. So what single-minded people do, brethren and sisters, is when you are persecuted and when people take advantage of you, because it's good, it's going to happen in life, and when things happen to you that you look back and say, well, that wasn't fair, that shouldn't happen, instead of being angry at God, instead of saying God's not involved, single-minded people realize that it's okay, I've got to simply, this is my opportunity to reveal the character of Christ. I don't have to go after these people. I don't have to take vengeance. I don't have to lash out at them and scream at them. We don't have to do those kind of things, because vengeance is God's. And it's clearly pointed out in Deuteronomy 32 that God will take care of things. Vengeance is His. He will do it in His own time. Or Psalm 94, our Lord God, to whom vengeance belongs. O God, whom vengeance belongs, shine forth. Or again, see, this is another example of how Paul and James were dealing with these same issues. Paul's dealing with this same thing in the Romans, when he writes to the Romans and encourages them, look, when these bad things come on you and you're persecuted like that, you don't have to avenge yourselves, because single-minded people believe that God will take care of it. So he said in Romans 12 there, at verse 19, beloved, do not avenge yourselves, but rather give place to wrath, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. And he puts that right in chapter 12 when he first gets into his exhortational points. As a result of all of his exposition, he knew that some of them were thinking, because of what was happening, they wanted to take vengeance themselves. You'll see it again in Hebrews 10. It's another place where Paul's writing to the Hebrews and reminding them, it's okay, you're going to be persecuted. Things are going to happen. Your own countrymen are going to take advantage of you. And in Hebrews 11, he lists out for them all those judges that had to suffer persecution from their own countrymen. He mentions Samson and Jephthah and Gideon and all these people that were abused by their own countrymen, and says, don't be surprised. It's going to happen, just like it did before. But single-minded people trust God, and they realize God will take care of it. He will repay. So the way then you find, if you're in those situations, how do you get through it? How do you respond in such a way that you reflect the character of Christ? How do we handle things where we feel like we're unjustly being treated? And James's solution here, just like he gave us a solution in chapter 4 to how you deal with that and everybody shows some humility, his solution to suffering through trials like this, where you're being abused and persecuted, is patience. Patience. God's trying to find out if you're single-minded, and will you really trust Him and patiently go through it and let God take care of the situation? Or are we going to be the kind of person that jumps in and handles it our way? Where are we at in our spiritual life? So this is not rocket science stuff. It's pretty simple to see what James is after. But he's just laying it on the table and saying, look, if we really believe and we are single-minded and we understand God's involved in this and we have the confidence like Joseph that in everything God is working for good, we will patiently go through these situations until God takes care of it and takes care of it. And He'll do a much better job of taking care of it than we ever could. So he then brings up three examples. This is typical James. He doesn't just say it and then imagine you think of the examples. He lays out on the table three examples of cases of people that have patience. And what's really good to James is he picks examples like things you can relate to. The farmer. So he takes something that everybody knows what it's like as a farmer, all you farmers out there, and they would have had a lot of farmers that he was writing to, and they'd all know that when they plant their crops, they didn't have hose spigots they could turn on. They didn't have irrigation things that they could use. Big tanks of water that they'd saved up for when it rains. They had to wait on God. The farmer has to patiently wait. And then he uses the example of the prophets. So this is typical James. He doesn't just say, well, you can tell by nature. He uses a natural example, and then he knows, all right, in the Bible, we got to get our Bibles out. Here's some Bible examples too. And then he also then deals with, well, what about the impact in your own life? What about something very personal, where you've been hit with an illness, and there's sickness, and the patience that it takes to go through that? So he picks three good, broad examples that would cover all those different aspects in order to help people see that single-minded people patiently wait for God. And that's the way he's going to finish up this whole section here. So the single-minded farmer in this case, what he does is he plants his crops and he waits. And he waits for the early rains, hoping that God will bring the early rains to germinate the crops and get them growing. And then later on, he has to patiently wait for the latter rains, because it's one thing to get the crops growing, but it's a whole other thing right before you harvest your crop. If you can get those latter rains, if you can have the early and the latter rains, then you can get the full development of the fruit, whatever it be, whether it be the corn or wheat or whatever it is. The latter rains are what allow the fruit to really grow in the end. And so a farmer patiently waits. They wait for God to handle the situation. And you can imagine, if you were a farmer and you were depending on this for being your food for the future, and maybe this was your economic crop that you're getting as well, you'd get a little stressed out at times. You'd feel the pinch of the fact that there's droughts. You saw here in Australia, you guys have had some droughts, haven't you, over the last few years? Australia's been in a pretty long-term drought. And you see how people get a bit stressed out over water use and so on. But what God does with that is he uses that in our life. He uses those economic situations that we're in our farming or our jobs, whatever they are, to try to help us spiritually grow so that we learn to trust him and we believe that he really is in control of those situations. And so that's one example that he picks. And so he then says, well, look, you got to be patient like that too, just like the farmer. We got to all go home now and be like farmers. In verse 8, you also be patient and establish your hearts, for the coming of the Lord is at hand. Now, you look back at that and say, that's 2,000 years ago. The coming of the Lord is at hand. Well, Jesus Christ didn't really return at that point. But the coming of the Lord was at hand in the sense of coming to take care of the persecution of the rich. It really wasn't that long before it came in at that point, and AD 70 was right on their doorstep. So I really think that's what he's after at that point. And so what he then does then is says, look, after the farmer example, he says, be patient, establish your hearts. God's going to take care of it. The Lord's coming is at hand. And what you want to do in verse 9 is don't grumble against another, brethren, lest you be condemned. And behold, the judge is standing at the door. So as I was saying, when you're looking at ecclesial problems and you start looking at these situations that God brings into your life when you fall into various trials and troubles come up in the ecclesia, and we know that the solution is right over there, I want to get to that point. God really does care about how we get to that point. Are we going to patiently let him work it out in a godly way, in a Christ-like spirit? Are we going to jump into the situation, feel like I've got to take care of it, and rush the solution through and then abuse people along the way? And single-minded folks won't do that. They will just, instead, they won't grumble against one another. They're not going to complain. They still treat each other nicely. We still show love and kindness and respect to each other. And we realize that the judge is standing at the door. And he will take care of those things. We don't have to do them all. Now, I know there's times in ecclesial life where problems do crop up and some event happens and the arranging board has to take care of that. But there's a lot of other events in life that we could let go. We could let God take care of them. And I really think that's the kind of stuff James is talking about right here. He's not talking about a brother or sister who goes doctrinally off the track and they're leading our young people astray or something and we might have to get involved in a situation. He's dealing with other situations where people are mistreating one another through character things and through the stuff that happens in the daily working out of ecclesial life, or in the abuse of an employer in this case, and being patient about it. Single-minded folks trust God knows what he's doing, and he'll take care of it. So he goes back then and looks at the patience of the prophets. Now, this is his next one. He's going to say, look at the prophets. Look at how patient they were. You can go back through Samuel, just patiently waiting with the people, patiently waiting with Saul, hoping that Saul would change. And Micaiah, remember we looked at him, how patient these fellows were. This prophet gets thrown in jail, pulled out of jail, and he still comes in and tells folks that what God says. And he gets thrown back in jail again when he's done. You know, and this is how these people were treated. Elijah and the patience that he had, praying for 3.5 years, going through the drought, experiencing it, hoping he could change the community. Elisha was the same way. Jeremiah, Ezekiel, Daniel, you can just go through every prophet, how patient they were, doing what God asked them to do, speaking an unpopular message. They got ridiculed, hated by their own communities, but they patiently waited for God to vindicate their message. And that's what prophets did. And there's so many examples of those. He could just say, like, consider the prophets, and they'd go back and think about them. Then he specifically, though, points out Job. Now, that's a good one because, you know, this is one of those famous passages when he mentions, indeed, we count them blessed who endure. And you've heard of the perseverance of Job. Now, here's a fella everybody's heard about. Look at how he patiently waited what came on him. Now, when all that trouble came on Job and he lost his family, he lost his house, he lost his health, and he lost all these things, is that something God did on Job because he deserved it? Was God trying to punish him and destroy him? No. By the end of the whole experience, Job realized that he had heard of God by the hearing of the ear. Now he had a personal relationship with God and understood him better than he ever had. So you look back at somebody like Job, and what you can imagine is Job's going through the story, and we read it. He's asking God, he's begging God for his day to talk to him and try to understand what's going on. Oh, yes, he got pushed into the position of thinking that I'm going to fix God and I'm going to straighten him out. But really, he was trying to simply get to the point where he could lay all the information on the table and find out, why is God doing this? And he was waiting for an answer. And when the answer finally came, and Elihu makes the suggestion to Job and says, Job, you ever thought about maybe God does this to keep you from going down a pathway where you would go into the pit? That there's such a thing as preventive medication in God's plan and how he works with people? You ever even considered that, Job? And I mean, Job was shocked. He never looked at God that way. I mean, God actually does things in our life, not to punish us, but because he's trying to prevent us from going down a pathway where we'll go astray from the truth. He's trying to prevent something from happening. It was a whole new idea that they had never even considered before. And then God, of course, comes in and explains the bigger picture to Job. So when Job was going through all this, though, he doesn't lash out at people. He does use a little sarcasm here and there. If you get a modern version, you can see that in Job's writings. He uses a little sarcasm once in a while. He says, oh, yes, what wonderful counselors you've been to me and how helpful you've been. And you get some things like that he would say because he's so frustrated at them and they really hadn't been helpful at all. But he didn't lash out at these people, and he didn't abuse his three friends. And in the end, you know, I really think that what Job did, is, and the reason he brings up Job, is because he's like an extreme case of somebody who was dealing with ecclesial members, his friends. They were abusing him, coming at him, saying, Job, it's you! Job, it's you! And they're pressuring him, which happens sometimes in ecclesial life. And in the end, Job prayed for them. He never lost his love for them. And this is what Bible people do, because you're single-minded. You believe God's in control. This is his family, and they're learning too. His three friends were learning as he went through all this. And in the end, he could step back and watch his life like Joseph and say, wow, you guys all meant this for evil. The Satan came up with all these ideas because you had evil intentions on me. But you know what? God meant it for good, because we all needed to learn something. And in the end, he can pray for the very people that had pushed him into the corner. What a great example to use of how single-mindedness changes the way we treat other people. And so he gives the example of Job. And then he goes off into this section about don't swearing. Now, maybe we don't relate to that a whole lot today, but back then I guess this was a bigger problem that they have about swearing and taking God's name and swearing an oath. You see, Jesus mentions it as well in Matthew 5. The people would just like swear an oath out and they'd bring God into it somehow, or they'd carefully say they'll swear by heaven or they'll swear by earth or I'll swear by the temple or something like that, because then if I really need to, I can just, in the end, I don't have to keep my oath. But he said, don't do that kind of stuff. We don't want to like throw out those extreme cases like that and swear by these things. Instead, keep your mouth, watch your tongue, and just say yes and no. That's good enough. We don't have to get into all those things. So then he leaves this section here at the end about, is anybody in verse 13, is anyone among you suffering? Let him pray. Is anyone cheerful? Let him sing songs. Is anyone among you sick? Let him call for the elders of the ecclesia. And so what single-minded people do is you're always looking for God's involvement. If you're suffering, we talk to God and we pray. If we're cheerful, we thank God for the good gifts that He has given to us. And we realize that the good times are not a result of me and all the hard work I put in, but because God has blessed us. And we thank Him by singing psalms to Him. And if anybody's sick, we call for the elders. We get the ecclesia on board, and we try to get the ecclesia to help us out and pray for those people looking for some kind of response. Now, I really think his reason for bringing up about the sickness at the end right here, if you wonder, like, why does he throw in sickness at the end, is because James saw this would be a really good way of taking people in ecclesial life that might have been misusing one another and might have been at odds with one another. They were saying things about each other they shouldn't say. There were wars and fightings going on. And James simply says, do you realize what the angels have to do when that happens? They have to bring sickness into our ecclesia. They have to bring somebody down. They have to, because they're trying to talk to us. They're trying to get us back together and unite us. And so they bring sickness, and somebody loses health, hoping that the whole ecclesia will come back together. And you will call the elders and you will pray for them. And that the ecclesia will now be united and sort of like lay aside their differences that they've had and realize somebody's in need. Somebody needs our help. And they get together, and as a group, you unitedly pray for the person. What a great way that angels have of bringing us back together when ecclesias are at odds. But it's so sad that they ever have to do that. That they have to go to a point where they have to bring illnesses and sicknesses like that into our midst. But that's one of the things they can use in order to bring about unity. That's actually what Elihu threw into Job and made him think about. Do you realize why God makes people sick? He isn't trying to destroy them. He's trying to save them. It's a preventive thing, he says. And Job had never even thought about that before. I got a feeling that that's really what James does right here. He brings in the same kind of thing, and encouraging them that, look at, when illnesses come and sicknesses are there in your ecclesia, this is an opportunity for calling for all the elders, not just some, but you get the whole group. And everybody unites for once, instead of having wars and fights like they might at meetings and differ on an issue of how they're going to work it out. Everybody's on the same page, praying for the health of this person, praying for each other that they might be healed. And we confess our trespasses to one another, because God uses sicknesses in order to impact our lives. And He doesn't do it just because of me. If I get sick, it's not just for me. This is what Job had to get out of. He's doing it to impact the lives of others. And that's the big picture of how God uses illnesses. Yes, it affects me. And yes, I'm going to learn something from it when I am sick. But there's also all those other people that are involved. And the opportunity of having everybody come together and unite, that's one of the tools that God can use in order to reach our hearts and change our lives. And God does respond to those prayers. It's not always the answer we want. But there are times where, yes, He will respond. And when an ecclesia comes together, He can bless the results of those prayers. And you see examples of that in the scriptures that we already looked at, how God's different pathways that He can choose. And that's why we go to God in prayer, believing that it is going to make a difference in the lives of these people. And He brings up Elijah, of course, at the end, because what a great example of a man who was committed to the ecclesia and who prayed and prayed for these people. And the effective, fervent prayer of a righteous man has great power in its effects. Elijah did it for the good of the nation. He wanted everybody to come together. He was looking for the time when they'd go up to Mount Carmel and the whole nation would be united and they'd run down from the mountain, you know, really believing that God was involved in their life. Didn't work, but it was a good plan, and that's really what Elijah was after. He had great motives in this case right here. And so, you know, he asked in this case, and God blessed what he was doing. Not because he wanted to spend it on himself, but because he was asking for the good of the ecclesia. He really wanted to save all those other people. Now, have you ever wondered at the end of this story, at the end of the letter of James? This used to bother me a lot, because the letter ends up in verses 19 and 20 on a note I would never have expected. If anybody's wandering from the truth and somebody brings him back, let him know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save his soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. You ever wonder, like, why does it end like that? Why would James do that in the end? But if you follow through the letter and you realize what's been happening in this letter about how people have been using prejudice and misjudging people, people have been using their tongues and lashing out at other people. There have been wars and there have been fightings. And you look back in your ecclesia over the last 10 years, 20 years, have there been times where those bickerings and those wars, the use of our tongues, and the, you know, the prejudice that we have about somebody where we make them feel like we don't want them? And we've like forced people out of ecclesial life. And James realized this is what was happening then. Because of all these troubles, people were leaving the ecclesia. They were going out and disappearing. And so what he does in the end is he lays it all on the line and he says, look, if you caught this at all, what you'll do is you'll humble yourself, you'll trust in God, and you individually will go out and seek those lost sheep that you maybe have been responsible for why they left the ecclesia. Because of our bad behavior. Because of things that I said or ways that I treated somebody. And I was wrong. And so we confess our faults before one another. We go out and we seek the lost sheep. And we bring them back to the ecclesia. Because this is what God does. This is the ultimate case of being like God. We go seek those people. This is where real humility gets involved, brothers and sisters. This is the big challenge. If we have done those things, if we have made mistakes, we've made decisions, we've disfellowshipped people and we've cut them off and we've made them leave the truth in a sense because of mistakes we have made, then James leaves us with the ultimate challenge of go home, humble yourself before the mighty hand of God, and go out and give them a call. Talk to those people. Invite them over for a meal. And admit to them that maybe we goofed. Maybe we made a mistake back then and we really want you back. Because if you do that, you're like God in seeking those lost sheep. And let him who know that he who turns a sinner from the error of his way will save a multitude from death and cover, or save his soul from death and cover a multitude of sins. So as we leave the Bible school and go home, time to pack up right now, let's go home committed to be more single-minded, convinced that God really is working in our lives. In every aspect of our lives, he's involved. Because really, as a parent, he wants you to make it, and he's trying to draw you into his family that you might share his holiness. And let's refuse to show partiality. Let's let God's word control our tongues so that we don't mistreat people and say things we shouldn't say in our families, in our homes, in our ecclesias. And learn to be more patient, like these prophets, of waiting on God to take care of it. And let's commit, as James would say, to be a doer of the word. In our homes and ecclesias, out on the job, over at school, we have to be a doer of the word and not a hearer only, looking for ways to serve one another through love, because we certainly don't want to have a faith that has no works and it's dead, or as James would call it, was useless. We want to have a faith that shows other people the joy that we have as living as members of the family of God, and we want to use that faith to draw those people into God's family, hoping for the day in which we'll all finally be together, where no continents will divide us and great barriers of water, and there won't be any more need for goodbyes, as somebody was saying this morning, but we'll all be together in God's family forever and have the benefits of that as we work with a group of people who are all doing it for God and for Christ and for the betterment of the family. And we've lost all of those things of the flesh where we don't do it because of lusts and envy and desires for ourselves. What a great opportunity we have, brothers and sisters, to implement these things now. And what a great thing we have to look forward to of being members of God's family forever. Thanks very much for all yours.